The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering backup solutions that help protect digital data in-home or at work, and offering data recovery services for damaged hard drives or lost files. More info at TechServe.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. We have some thoughts this hour on popes, Pope Francis to be particular, on U.S. responsibility for the refugee crisis in Europe, also a haunting story of a war still snuffing out lives far from the battlefield. But we begin this hour thinking hard about prison in America. There are more than 2.2 million people serving sentences behind bars in America, many more in jail awaiting trial, millions of ex-felons with criminal records who find that once released, their access to social services, health care, legal information, and counseling all vanishes. That's right. In-prison programs offer more support for these millions of Americans than the outside world does in rebuilding their lives. And there's been a broad and urgent realization that none of this is working, that our whole system of sentencing and incarceration that was born in the tough-on-crime political era of the 80s and 90s needs to be reformed. How did we get here? Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, how could something that was second nature in politics a few decades ago, being tough on crime, be replaced by a new movement for, in some cases, radical change?
It's a really interesting dynamic, John. And to get part of the answer, we have to go back to how we got here, back to the 80s. You mentioned it. The war on drugs, societal fear of violent crime, and politicians' quest to be tough on crime.
Bush and Dukakis on crime. Bush supports the death penalty for first-degree murderers. Dukakis not only opposes the death penalty, he allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison. One was Willie Horton, who murdered a boy in a robbery, stabbing him 19 times.
Now, John, that's the infamous Willie Horton ad from the 88 presidential campaign. It's what made Michael Dukakis, who was the former governor of Massachusetts and had sponsored a furlough program that let Willie Horton out of jail and committed that crime, it's what made Michael Dukakis soft on crime. Now, that attack actually came not just from Republicans like future President George H.W. Bush, but also from Democrats like Al Gore in the primary. America was terrified of violent crime, terrified of drugs, and our politics reflected it front to back. Flash forward here to 1994.
Let us roll up our sleeves to roll back this awful tide of violence and reduce crime in our country. We have the tools now. Let us get about the business of using them.
You recognize that voice, President Bill Clinton there in 1994, signing the 94 crime bill. That crime bill, John, is now blamed even by Bill Clinton himself as being one of the factors that helped fill the prisons with offenders, many of them nonviolent offenders, and got us into the mess that we're in today. The 94 crime bill had tougher sentences for drugs, lots of nonviolent offenders. Also, the three strikes policy, three felonies, life sentence. Many experts and analysts blame three strikes now for putting millions and millions of people in prison who probably don't need to be there or are having a hard time getting rehabilitated. But not just the 94 crime bill. Lots of other factors, too, seem to have contributed to this problem. Deinstitutionalization of mental hospitals in the Reagan administration back in the 80s. It was an important step after a Supreme Court order. The Supreme Court said you have to treat mentally ill people in the least restrictive means possible. And that meant that lots and lots of mental hospitals were emptied of patients. That was a good thing. Many of those patients never got appropriate treatment after they were released, and their new warehouse, John, became the prisons instead of the mental hospitals, a big factor. Also, lots of people point to privatization of prisons and perverse incentives that may have created for states to cut costs while transferring money to corporations and getting more money the more prisoners that got into jail. But John, there's a call now to say, as you said, none of this has worked. And I'm going to play you an interesting voice here. Listen to Senator John Cornyn. He's a conservative, self-described law and order conservative Republican from Texas. He's also a former AG from Texas, a prosecutor, and a former Texas Supreme Court judge.
Well, there's no question about it. The pendulum has definitely swung. The irony is that that being tough on crime, locking people up in prison, does work, because when people are in prison, they don't have the time or the freedom to commit other acts of crime. What it leaves out of the equation, though, is the fact that most people will exit the prison at some point, and we have an interest in civil society in trying to encourage them to productive lives and not a life of crime.
Is Senator Cornyn going to be a leader on this reform movement?
Oh, there's no question about it. He has a powerful position on the Judiciary Committee, as I said, former prosecutor, former judge. He's got a lot of clout on this issue. He's one of many, and it's really running the political gamut here, from libertarians and conservatives to civil libertarians and liberals. Everyone seems to be on board. Now, there's no consensus yet on exactly what's going to get in to a criminal justice reform package. The players here keep saying we're close to introducing a bill, we're close, and they're not quite there yet because there's still some disagreements over what's going to be in a package that tries to move to the floor here. But we do know some of the parts. One, fewer incarcerations for nonviolent drug crimes. Not violent drug offenders, not traffickers, but the estimated hundreds of thousands of people who may still be in prison or jail for nonviolent drug offenses, particularly users, John. They want to make a change to that policy. They want to reform bail rules to prevent poor people who are accused of crimes from being de facto in prison because they can't afford to pay bail. That's a sense of imprisonment because of poverty, because you can't pay your bond or your bail. There's also a move to have more diversion to mental health treatment instead of incarceration. Sentencing reform is going to be a big deal. Some of it is controversial. There are moves to have good behavior policies and rehabilitation program policies within prison that can cut your time, lessen your sentence. Cornyn's on board with that, but Cornyn's not on board with reducing mandatory minimums. There's disagreement about this, and it's still controversial. Mandatory minimums for lots of different crimes, some of them nonviolent, that takes away, they say, judges' discretion on how long people should spend in jail. And that has resulted, some advocates say, in long sentences where judges and prosecutors don't have the discretion to give people lighter sentences if they merit it. And then, of course, post-release policies. How are you treated, John? How do you rebuild your life after you come out of prison? That's a big area that needs reform.
And what's the perspective of ex-cons who look at this reform movement and see something that might have something positive for them?
Well, this is just one facet of reform, but it's a really big deal with a lot of people. How the past and the law can conspire against ex-felons' future, even after they've paid their debt and done their time.
This kept me from getting a lot of positions because in my field, they're going to do a background check.
Joshua Pruitt is 32. He moved to Washington, D.C. to pursue a career and to try to get beyond his criminal background.
Me right now, I'm just this mess up with old charges that need to pursue a change and find someone that can believe in me and help me change and wipe my background and clear it up.
Like so many Americans, that 7-year-old felony got Josh fired off of a job and has kept him out of the workforce ever since.
I obtained a job in my field one time in the state of Alabama, running VLANs, basically installing the internet in these state parks. But once that company found out that I had background charges, they immediately terminated my employment. In 2012. I haven't worked for anyone, even subcontracted, in 2012.
According to the National Employment Law Project, an estimated 70 million Americans, that's one quarter of U.S. adults, have an arrest history that can show up on a background check, even if they were never convicted of a crime.
I believe I still have that issue with my criminal background, because when I fill out applications, I put that check mark.
Saul Green is 60 years old. He's unemployed and living in a shelter on Massachusetts Avenue here in Washington, D.C. Saul doesn't use crack cocaine anymore, but his conviction and prison time for possession has kept him out of the workforce. Every time he applies for a job, it's a box he has to check that keeps him back.
Do you have a criminal background? And yes, I do. Then I elaborate, which I didn't elaborate the last time. You know, I just checked the box, but didn't elaborate. So now I'm elaborating. Therefore, that since they look at my criminal background, they say, well, we won't take a chance on him and move on.
A national campaign started all the way back in 2004 urges employers to ban the box and remove the "have you ever been convicted of a crime" question from employment applications. The point here is to give each candidate a fair shot at employment once the employer determines that they're qualified. Now, Saul says that's a start, but the other problem is what an employer can do after they hire you.
Not just the box, it's also the background check.
That's David Treadwell. He's executive director of the Central Union Mission here in Washington, D.C. That's where both Saul and Joshua live.
They're working on a thing to protest, ban the box. But you got to also, it's in the background check. So it's not as simple as just banning the box. It's being willing to recognize when a person has cleaned himself up and give him a chance. We need employers to work with us, to open the door and give people a chance.
Treadwell says that despite Saul's recovery and his work ethic and tenacity, there's only so much the organization can do for him.
He worked with us. He was on time. He follows instructions. He's a good employee. We can depend on him. All those things that you need on your record, and it hasn't helped. We even bought him a cell phone so that he could take the interviews, and we still haven't found him a job.
And it hasn't helped. Why? What do you think's going on?
The felony. The felony is on his record.
I mean, we have a crisis of monumental proportion.
New Jersey Democratic Senator Cory Booker is just one of many lawmakers on Capitol Hill looking at all aspects of criminal justice reform. He says there's a moral component here that requires an overhaul of the system to address the problems of mass arrest and mass incarceration.
In the course of human history, there hasn't been this kind of extreme where a nation has imprisoned this many of its own people. And even you're talking about imprisonment, there's also American jails, which have 19 times the admissions in prisons do, and even arrests. We're now at the point in our culture where we're arresting, you know, about 75 to 100 million Americans have been arrested, which is crazy that you would have almost one third of the people in your nation being arrested. So we have a crisis in mass incarceration, hyper arresting. And this problem is not going to be solved with one tool.
How convicted felons' history follows them after they get out of jail is just one narrow piece of broader criminal justice reform. But it's a part that people like Joshua and Saul say is key for them to rebuild their lives after paying their debt to society.
Todd Zulick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, on the extraordinary levels of incarceration in the United States compared with places around the world and the political momentum behind the reform. Tomorrow, we'll look at what's happening on Capitol Hill, why despite an ugly partisan dysfunctional atmosphere, lawmakers from every corner of the political map are suddenly ready to work together to try for real reform. The refugee crisis in Europe continues, with Germany agreeing to accept well over 800,000 people out of the more than 6 million Syrians estimated to be on the move. In the last year, the U.S. has accepted just 1,500 Syrian refugees, but the president raised that to 10,000 last week and then over the weekend pushed that number up to 100,000 by the year 2017. Ann Richard is Assistant Secretary of State for Population, Refugees, and Migration. Assistant Secretary Ann Richard, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you very much.
So what is the president responding to here?
Well, the president would like to bring 10,000 Syrian refugees in the coming fiscal year. But the larger numbers you cited are numbers of refugees we're bringing from all around the world, from lots of different war zones and hotspots. The situation in Europe seems to be mainly triggered by a stream of refugees leaving the Middle East, many of them Syrians. And in the 4.5 years of war there, they have not been able to start new lives. They've been able to live in a sort of suspended situation. Their families, though, are very interested in seeing breadwinners go to work and children get enrolled in school. And my belief is that a lot of the people showing up in Europe right now are seeking better lives, seeking a future for their families.
And that's an appropriate mission for them, don't you think?
All human beings want to do that. I think many Americans can sympathize with families trying to find a way to live productive, fulfilling lives.
How can the U.S. help in this matter for the Syrians?
What we do is we do a couple things. We're the world leader in providing humanitarian assistance to people who are either inside Syria trying to survive or who have fled to neighboring countries and are refugees. So we provide assistance to the leading international organizations like the UN Refugee Agency, the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, and other do-good organizations and the leading non-governmental organizations working in the area. We also bring refugees to the United States. You had mentioned we brought 1,500 Syrian refugees this past year, and we intend to bring many, many more in the coming years. We have difficulty doing that quickly because of the process we have takes 18 to 24 months to bring refugees. And another thing we do, of course, is at the State Department, We lead in U.S. diplomacy overseas in trying to bring peace to that very volatile region.
Why does it take 24 months to bring a desperate family to the United States?
The process has many stages in it. Families are referred by the UN Refugee Agency to us. We are open to accepting some of the most vulnerable people, but we have to have a case put together for them and then have that case reviewed by an officer from the Department of Homeland Security to ensure that the people qualify as refugees, that the reasons that they're fleeing meet our laws, and to also ensure that their background checks out, that they're not people who have lied to us or are criminals or are terrorists trying to sneak into the United States. Most people are who they say they are. Most refugees are innocent civilians trying to find a better life for themselves. But our process is based on being extra careful.
Isn't it something of an insult to be so concerned about security with these desperate families coming from Syria? I mean, of course, you want to check people to see if they're terrorists, but it just seems to me that we weren't terribly picky about security when we were helping the freedom fighters in Afghanistan years ago and they became Al-Qaeda. Why don't we just put the humanitarian stuff at the top and worry about the security later on? We've got police here in the U.S.
We have the vast majority of refugees coming to the United States are people who will never get in trouble in the United States, will turn out to be great residents of our country, and many prove to end up being taxpayers and local community leaders, and some even become truly great Americans. I mean, we've had two secretaries of state who came to the United States as refugees, including my former boss, Madeleine Albright. So I agree that most of these refugees do not pose a threat to the United States, most of the applicants. But there is a real concern in Congress that we should be extra careful in who gets brought across our borders. This is the most heavily vetted program of any program for travelers to the United States. I have to be responsive to both concerns, to the humanitarian impulse to bring people in and also to the security impulse. And this is really something that has grown stronger. I'm hearing it more from communities in the United States and from Congress since 9/11.
Hearing what? The concern about security?
That's right.
But wouldn't we call that racial profiling if police were doing it in the United States? But if the U.S. State Department is doing it, then it's called appropriate security?
I don't think that we profile based on race because we are bringing so many people from Africa, for example. We've brought more Africans than in the last 5 years at any time. I am worried that in the mind of the public, they may be extra concerned about bringing Muslims from the Middle East. And for me, since I meet so many refugees, I know these are just ordinary families. And a lot of the aid workers who I work alongside of when I travel in the Middle East are, of course, Muslim. And I know that the U.S. has freedom of religion. So I believe that these groups can thrive in the United States. I do worry sometimes that there is a Islamophobia that is behind some of the concerns about security. But there's an appropriate concern about security that I must respond to.
Ann Richard is Assistant Secretary of State for Population, Refugees, and Migration. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com. Brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide. With personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com. Curious.com, committed to helping people learn more than 17,000 skills like marketing, meditation, and metalworking. Curious.com, grow your skills. Learn more at Curious.com/PRI.
The war in Afghanistan. So many U.S. soldiers who saw the worst of the combat was a journey to a place they can never leave. Here's Navy SEAL Marcus Luttrell telling the story of watching a fellow soldier die.
They killed him. And I put my weapon down in a gunfight while my best friend was getting killed. So that pretty much makes me a coward.
How can you say that?
Say what?
That putting your weapon down makes you a coward.
Because that is a cowardice act, if you put your weapon down in a gunfight. They say every man has his breaking point. I never thought I'd find mine.
Marcus Luttrell on CBS's 60 Minutes. Luttrell not only found his breaking point, he discovered that there is no way to unbreak yourself after you come home. Similarly, Marine Corporal Clay Hunt was broken while a sniper in the 2nd Battalion, 7th Marine Regiment in Afghanistan. For a while, Hunt was a model for soldiers getting treatment for depression and PTSD. He became an advocate for aggressive treatment. He urged veterans to speak out about mental illness and to find a support network. But it was not enough. In March of 2011, he took his life after years of getting what his family described as less than adequate care at the Veterans Administration. He became another casualty of an unprecedented suicide rate in the 7th Marines, four times higher than the male veteran population at large. President Obama signed the Clay Hunt Suicide Prevention for American Veterans Act in February of 2015, and Richard Selke, Clay's stepfather, was there.
At the end of the day, when an individual makes the decision to take their life, they've given up hope. And so the message here is, please don't do that.
The troubling story of the 7th Marines and their attempts to watch each other's backs if the Veterans Administration can't has just been told in the New York Times by a reporter, David Phillips, who joins us now. Welcome, David.
Thanks for having me.
David, describe how you learned in your reporting that the suicide of one individual would haunt and almost reach out to other individuals, making them feel as though they were next.
I actually avoided writing about this for a long time because the data on it was so bad and was so misused. There's an often used statistic that 22 veterans kill themselves a day that you hear all over the place. And it's completely meaningless. It gives you no rate. It doesn't tell you who's at risk. All it does is make all veterans look like a bunch of victims. And that is absolutely not true. So I stayed away. And then one of Clay Hunt's best friends, a man named Jake Wood, I was talking with him about another story, and I asked him what I always ask when I'm doing reporting, which was, what should we be writing about that we're not? And he said suicide. And I probably literally rolled my eyes. I'm like, okay, here we go. He's going to give me the 22 suicides a day thing. And he said, look, all I know is we've had 12 guys in my unit kill themselves since I came back. And that was a huge number, huge number. And so that drove me to try and figure out what the story was.
And what is the story? How does it affect them all, even though one person makes the decision?
Well, you know, it's a human story. Like the clip you just ran, it's about guilt. It's about grief. It's about regret. These guys are no different from all of us in that they've gone to war and experienced both the best and the worst of humanity. And when they come home, it's very hard for them to figure out what to do with that. And some of them do go on to do amazing things, and others, they're unable to work through the trauma. And as their friends begin dying, they see it as a legitimate way out, a legitimate response.
Can you see it as a legitimate response?
No, because I've talked to too many of these guys who made serious attempts. I've talked to three guys in this one battalion who put a gun to their head and pulled the trigger and are still alive today. And whatever hole of despair they were in was temporary.
Why does treatment, effective treatment, seem to elude the Veterans Administration in cases like this, and particularly for these very traumatized veterans?
Well, it is not just the Veterans Administration. It's our society as a whole. I think we're at the very beginning of learning how to treat this in an effective way. You know, it was only a generation ago that we recognized war trauma as a legitimate injury.
And one particular story in your piece, again, about this experience haunting everyone else, this poor Marine carries with him the memories of stuffing the unidentifiable remains of one of his closest friends into a sleeping bag to get out of a horrible IED firefight. How do you get rid of something like that?
I don't know. That's for each individual to answer, right?
The veterans in this unit decided to help each other in a way that went way beyond what the VA was doing. Have they been effective in watching each other's backs?
So what they did is they created essentially a social network, a way that using online tools they could watch out for each other if anyone was having problems, and then alert the closest Marine physically to them in their state and have them go see them in person. By their own account, it is a duct tape and chewing gum solution because they were at their wits' end. No one was coming to help them, so they had to help themselves. And it has had some success, but it's limited in what it can do. And these guys aren't professionals. They're just friends helping each other. And so they can't do it all by themselves.
How much do you think questioning the actual mission in Afghanistan contributes to this feeling of despair on the part of some of these soldiers?
I think to generalize would be difficult. Certainly men that I talked to, looking at what was gained compared to what was spent is very troubling to them. To lose people that they had the utmost respect for and now see that the same guys that they were fighting 5 years ago now completely control the area that they were fighting, I think is really demoralizing.
Is there anything you can say to them?
You know, I just don't think a lot of them feel like they fit anymore. I thought that they wouldn't want to talk to me. And I was amazed that dozens of them were willing and talked at length and in ways that they hadn't ever spoken to even their families about. There wasn't space in you know, our society to speak about. I think one of the things that bothers them most is that this was going on and no one seemed to care. You know, the VA didn't notice. They had been forgotten.
David Phillips is a reporter for our partner, The New York Times. His piece about the suicide rate of a particular unit in the Marines deployed to Afghanistan is a haunting account of precisely the mental illness that is a consequence of the Afghanistan war. David, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Pope Francis has had little good to say about Western capitalism since he ascended to the papacy. In communist Cuba this week, the Pope called for reforms and attracted excited crowds. Everywhere he goes, Pope Francis has called for greater support for the poor. He has condemned the wide income gap around the world and is expected to address the concentration of power in Washington, D.C. In the nation of separation of church and state, this very popular pope will arrive in the U.S. to begin a 5-day journey that will take him from Pennsylvania to D.C. to New York City and Georgia, including a meeting with President Obama. Jimmy Burns, journalist and author most recently of Francis, Pope of Good Promise, said amidst his candor and good humor, Francis has remained fundamentally true to his Jesuit education and to his beloved soccer obsession, which is one reason why he is bonded so quickly to Catholics and non-Catholics around the world.
I mean, I think the Jesuit thing, as it were, or the piece, as you put it, is actually the key to understanding Jorge Bergoglio, Pope Francis. In what way? I suppose in understanding his spirituality, the Ignatian spirituality taken from the founding father, Saint Ignatius. And I think a kind of phrase one often hears through Ignatian spirituality, which I personally identify with, is seeing God in all things, which is a pretty good point of departure because for a pope like Francis, because it means that he's got a very kind of universal attitude towards human engagement. One just has to see the extent to which he manages to engage with different faiths, with different presidents, heads of state, with different communities.
And when we think about you know, what the transition has been from John the 23rd to John Paul II to Benedict and to Pope Francis, many writers who've written in advance of the Pope's arrival suggest that there's more continuity between the papacy of Pope Benedict and Pope Francis than we have been led to believe up to now. What's your view on that?
First of all, I can't disagree completely with that view for the simple reason that Pope Francis himself has honoured Pope Benedict by having him, as we know, living within the Vatican walls in retirement. And, you know, which is not an easy thing to have your former boss literally living just up the road. And in a sense, if one looks at the way that Pope Francis was elected by the conclave, in a sense, he owes his election to Benedict's blessing. But to say that there's a very clear continuity, I would dispute that because, I mean, for the start, we're talking about the current pope obviously coming from a completely different political, social, economic, and I would suggest even spiritual environment, which is the sort of Latin American context, the Argentine context with its particular idiosyncratic political culture. And of course, Benedict came very much from a German, Eurocentric, European background. And also both men are, I mean, evidently clear to the world, are very different characters. I mean, you know, Benedict is undoubtedly a spiritual person, a contemplative person, a great theologian, but he has neither the charisma nor the natural human engagement of Francis. Benedict, particularly in his last years as Pope, seemed to be overwhelmed by the office. By contrast, Francis is like a man transformed. I mean, you know, a Pope which clearly feels that this office was almost waiting for him.
How does Francis break down these barriers without creating a revolution within the church? He seems to have simultaneously connected with people of the flock and also intimidated and really put a warning out to folks within the Vatican that it's no longer business as usual.
Yeah, it's a very delicate, both political, spiritual, and ecclesiastical road he is treading on. That is evident to all for the reason you've identified. I mean, he has spoken out very clearly about what he calls the sort of inward-looking church. He has this wonderful phrase as, you know, I don't want churches which are simply museum pieces where people go in behind closed doors and priests look inwards and not outwards. He wants a church looking out with open windows, which of course to many Catholics and indeed non-Catholics, this is like a breath of fresh air. But as you rightly note, for more traditional Catholics, you know, this has put a bit of a fear of God into them, quite literally. But having said that, I think it's important to emphasize that a key part of the Francis' persona, which again has to do with his Jesuit spirituality, which I think he is a man who is, I think, is quite astute politically. He takes steps that he's sure of, and only because of his own popularity and what is behind him. So he's not an isolated figure. He believes and shown that he is capable of listening to opposing points of view. He is open to discussion, and indeed he encourages discussion. The last thing Pope Francis wants to leave as his legacy is an utterly divided church. You know, we were on the brink of that in the last months of Benedict because of the Vatican scandals, because of the sexual abuse, because of the huge kind of betrayal that a lot of Catholics felt, many of whom left the church. And he is in a rebuilding exercise. He doesn't want to bring the whole building crumbling apart.
He's a football fan. I mean, he's a fanatic football fan. And everybody seems to know it who comes to St. Peter's Square. What is that about? And how does it affect you when you think about this fellow?
Well, as you probably know, we're both football fans. And now we have, as you say, an Argentine Pope who was brought up in a neighborhood of Buenos Aires where the local team is a declared fanatic of San Lorenzo. And I mean, where the two came together, of course, is a few months ago when Maradona went to visit Pope Francis, you know, the latest in a long line of personalities and heads of state who've found their way to Rome under this popular pope. And, of course, was absolutely delighted with Pope Francis, gave him a signed Argentine national team with the number 10, his favourite number, on it. And then Diego, or as he's known to his friends, Maradona, declared himself reconverted to the Catholic faith. So that's just one more who's come back into the fold, probably from the most unexpected source, because I never would have believed in a million years seeing Diego Maradona turning up at the Vatican and feeling himself humbled by a pope.
Jimmy Burns, journalist and author of Francis, Pope of Good Promise. Thanks so much, Jimmy.
Thanks a lot, John. It's been a great conversation. Thank you.
And here's something to take with you today, just in time for the Pope's visit, a new tree of life. You can add to it. It's an open source graph that purports to show how 2.3 million species on the Earth are related. Of course, there's a lot more than 2.3 million species even right now on the Earth, about 8.7 million. But using this graph, you can find out how your chocolate Labrador is related to a sponge. The Tree of Life 1.0 is open source, and scientists are inviting everyone to help with revision. So keep your eyes open and give them a call. Why don't you? You can always give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway and ask me anything on Twitter every day. I take your questions, sometimes your complaints. I do my best to get back to you personally. Tweet me your questions at Jay Hockenberry. And thanks so much for listening on this Monday. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Citrix, creator of GoToMeeting, connecting people and businesses in face-to-face online meetings from any device, featuring a personalized meeting room for a custom look. Learn more at GoToMeeting.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.